passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED lights, and more, whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Brandon Thurston from Wrestlenomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And we are live with this week's edition of Pollock and Thurston, John Pollock and Brandon Thurston coming at you. And here we are, Brandon. Another week, plenty to talk about. We have a guest on today's show still to come. We're going to cover everything from television ratings to buy rates to upcoming media calls.
We're going to do buy rates?
No, I was trying to play off of our intro there, but it eludes me. And of course, always my favorite person to hear from, Mark Shapiro. We're going to hear from him as well.
Yes.
He's not speaking to us directly, but you're going to hear his voice.
No.
And of course, Saudi Arabia is on the menu today. So look forward to all of that. Our guest later is Bradley Hope. He is the author of Blood and Oil, the co-author of this book that came out a number of years ago, looking at the rise of Mohammed bin Salman. So we're going to be talking with him about sort of the larger sports strategy that Saudi Arabia has invested in during this period of MBS's rise in the country, its effectiveness, and sort of what the temperature is within the country when it comes to a lot of these changes, the social progress that has been made, while juxtaposing it with some of the realities of the political limitations within the country. So I think everyone will look forward to that as Bradley Hope will be joining us on the street live. Live to tape from our discussion just a few hours ago. So looking forward to that one. But how are you doing, Brandon?
I'm fine. It looks like there's going to be a thunderstorm very soon here. I don't know about where you are, but I'm good. We're, the Saudi Arabia relationship, I'm looking at the press release. It is a 10-year deal. 10-year deal. COVID messed everything up, including this deal, though. So it started in 2018. A 10-year deal, I guess, would expire sometime in 2028. It might be a little bit longer because they missed some events during the pandemic. But that's a 10-year deal, $50 million every single event they do there. Now they do two events a year. Initially, when this deal was announced, they were only going to do maybe one event a year. But now it's very, very clearly two events. It was from the beginning, really.
There was never a year in this deal that they didn't do two events. But after the plane ride home that was quote unquote delayed, days after this announcement is made that they are extending their partnership to now be two events per year, which I guess it was more so this is now guaranteed. And during the pandemic, the way they had stated was that any missed events get tacked on to the back end of this deal. So in theory, they're going to make up those events that they missed during the pandemic. So this will probably go a little bit beyond that point. But on a broader scope, I don't think people have to be counting down to the end of this deal. It seems as though TKO is as entrenched as possible with Saudi Arabia. And that extends to the UFC in a major way, too.
I mean, really think about it, like it's especially in the WWE side of the business, like that $100 million a year it's now less than a tenth of their revenue. There was a time where that was a tenth of the revenue, but it's pretty close to, I don't know, what, 8%, something like that. So that's really baked into the expectations of this company, at least for the next several years. And Mark Shapiro, as we're going to play the clip, Mark Shapiro discussed how they're looking to expand that relationship. And he discussed on the TKO earnings call the week before, how that was a Vince McMahon relationship. He said Vince McMahon's name too. He's not afraid to say it.
Yeah.
But
it's like saying Beetlejuice these days. Yeah.
Yes. But no worries. Nick Khan has taken over that relationship, and he's buddy buddy with, I don't know if it's MBS or if it's the GEA chairman, Turki Alalshikh, but Nick Khan is totally, in control of that relationship, and it's going great.
Well, maybe MBS is going to start a podcast, and maybe Nick Khan will be a guest on his podcast in the future.
I would need a translator, but I would listen to that.
Let's hear from Mark Shapiro. This was at the, I don't want to let out or leave out any of the wording here of the JP Morgan conference that he was part of. This was called the JP Morgan Global Technology, Media and Communications Conference. Screaming for an acronym, but this is where Mark Shapiro appeared earlier this week speaking about TKO's involvement with Saudi Arabia and what is to come.
So you've seen us monetize site fees with the likes of Saudi Arabia for WWE. You can look for us to expand our current deal in the next 6 to 12 months. Very happy with MBS and the partnership we have there. We have two events a year. But we're already in discussions. Nick Khan is leading that for us in expanding that to more events. We also have a phenomenal deal in Abu Dhabi with the UFC where we're getting significant site fees and incentive packages there. And we've now expanded our partnership with them for other affiliate events, if you will, in the Middle East that they would participate in as we sell them to different countries. We've now expanded our Saudi Arabia relationship by not just having a UFC fight this June, but announcing for almost double the rights fee, another event next year. And I would tell you, David, we would be doing a longer term deal with Saudi Arabia if we already had one event under our belt. So that's another way of saying, as long as everything goes well in June, which we anticipate, I think Dana White would be very amenable to doing a much longer term deal in Saudi Arabia.
So this got a lot of people excited. TKO stock has been soaring this past week. It is up something like 15-16% over the past month. So trading at just over $107. So I think I think there's a myriad of factors into this stock increase. I think the fact that the antitrust suit is now in the rearview mirror, that is given a lot of optimism. But I think as well the idea that, let's remember when this stock took a hit when the PFL announced their investment from Saudi Arabia, and it seems that the UFC has really just been able to get in on the Saudi Arabia revenue, and it looks like to be a very, very strong relationship moving forward, and it's got a lot of people excited, including Mark Shapiro, who is a man that easily gets excitable.
Yes. And another thing that he talked about here is site fees. Site fees were brought up, and then he got into the notion that, wow, we have great site fees with Saudi Arabia. But he talked about having site fees for UFC fight nights, which I believe they just got one for the St. Louis show. Not only was it, as he said, the biggest gate in, well, the biggest grossing of a UFC fight night in their history, but they also got a site fee, I understand, of several hundred thousand dollars. And he talked about in the future getting site fees for Raw and SmackDown, which I think requires some thinking here. Domestically, I can't see there being site fees for Raw and SmackDown, which tour 52 weeks a year. It's the justification to me for site fees is for most events where we're talking outside of Saudi Arabia, where perhaps there's a public relations and there's a bigger investment happening there. It's the notion that you're having people travel in from outside. That creates all this extra sales tax revenue. That creates all this extra spending on hotels and restaurants and local businesses. That makes sense. But are people going to do that for what Raw and SmackDown are they going to do that for? I see it being packaged in as it was for Backlash, as it is, you know, in this case for the Saudi Arabia event on the Friday SmackDown, the Saturday King and Queen of the Ring. But a standalone site fee for just a Raw and SmackDown, at least domestically, doesn't make a lot of sense. But I could see it making some sense if you're going to do, you're doing an international tour, and maybe they do more of these international Raw and SmackDown tapings. That I could see making sense.
Well, the other option is what we saw at the Honda Center in February, where there was a UFC pay-per-view on the Saturday. Raw was there on the Monday, Raw being an add-on. And again, I think that more and more, I think we see a clearer picture of keeping SmackDown on Fridays attached to these weekend packages that you can sell. I'm with you. I think it's a tougher sell to have Raw or SmackDown on its own be able to get, especially a domestic site fee. And I don't even see Raw or SmackDown going international unless it's piggybacking with a premium live event.
Raw and SmackDown teaming, you know, being packaged with the UFC event, that does make more sense. And I would say all the more reason why SmackDown is likely, in my opinion, to stay on Friday. And I think, I mean, doesn't Raw make all the more sense to keep it on Monday? Obviously, Netflix is paying you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, and you're going to go on whatever night they probably really want you to go on. But I would think it'd be just WWE's benefit to keep it on Monday if you're going to continue to charge slight fees, if you can package that Monday event in with a Sunday event or a Saturday event or a Friday event, or string them all together, and you can always throw Power Slap wherever you want.
I think that's the whole thinking here. Like the money is locked in, and if you're looking at this now as a touring vehicle, it behooves them to be in that proximity of a weekend event as opposed to a Tuesday through Thursday middle of the week where it's on its own, which are, you want to be going to these municipalities, to different cities, and be able to attract tourism. That is the big sell now of their television and these fight nights, and finding a place for them on top of that.
And I would suggest when we talk about the stock price doing so well, and it is up to 107, which is that actually, if I look at the entire history, I think this will let me. If I look at the entire, it's going to look through all the indexes.
I think it might have been a little higher when it just launched, but this is, for all intents and purposes, this is the highest it's traded since the just initial public offering.
Yeah, it is. So on the first day, it was 100. So it hasn't really been over 100 since the merger, and we're well over 100 here. I think a lot of this has to do with maybe site fees, in terms of that's incremental on top of what people really expected when these two companies were put together. There are all these synergies. And as David Karnofsky, who's the JP Morgan analyst, said, maybe there's a little bit too much over speculation about how UFC and WWE could work together to create these weekends. But there seems to be more speculation about revenue. Hopefully for whoever is investing, for the sake of whoever is investing, hopefully justified speculation around, you know, the site fees, the money they can make off of those. That is in addition to what was already baked into this business.
Yeah. The other topics I think that garnered a lot of interest was Shapiro's discussion about the pay-per-views on the WWE side, indicating that they're getting hit up all the time. When are those PLEs
up? Yes.
When can we get at them? And what is the answer to that, Brandon? When are the WWE PLEs up for grabs?
That deal expires March 2026. So I would think about a year and a half is when I always expect these things to start getting renewed. Of course, we're down to the wire on AEW's deal, and we went much further towards expiration in WWE's case too. So I don't know, what's 18 months from March 2026? The beginning of 2025, I guess, something like that?
Which coincides where you are within... We have the ESPN deal with the UFC that ends at the end of 2025. So that's going to be interesting timing when you have the UFC pay-per-views and an extension, its entire domestic rights package with ESPN that, I mean, could garner. I am sure that the NBA numbers being thrown around, and people are looking at a Warner Brothers Discovery potentially being left without NBA programming. Well, where do they redistribute their programming budget for sports, and the UFC becomes that much more of an attractive property for a lot of places out there. So it's not just the WWE premium live events that are a major deal, but the biggest is the UFC rights and the pay-per-views. And Mark Shapiro even throwing out the idea of ESPN that'll be launching their direct-to-consumer app at some point over the next year or so, and just buying the pay-per-views outright as something to justify a $30 price tag for this direct-to-consumer app, and you get UFC pay-per-views exclusive.
Yeah. He was suggesting doing away with a la carte, right? He was suggesting doing away with this model that we've known in pro wrestling or MMA since like 1985 or whatever, that it would no longer be the, what is it now, $80?
It's plus a ESPN Plus subscription on top.
Unless you have NordVPN, right? But we're not promoting that.
Well, then you're very familiar with the Malaysia broadcast outlet.
So doing away with that upcharge and just baking that into this premium monthly fee, maybe.
Which would be a tremendous reward for your UFC consumer that is spending all this money, and to like that ESPN direct to consumer app, like you're imagining probably tops out at like $35 a month. And if that were to come with the pay-per-views, the caveat being TKO isn't handing these pay-per-views over for some discount or anything. They would want an unbelievable guarantee per month for handing over their most lucrative product.
But Bob Iger is going to have to pay up, or whoever gets the rights. Are you any more relieved in light of these revelations of the notion that, well, then maybe WE pay-per-views, WPLEs aren't going to end up on an upcharge again?
I do see like some kind of parallel strategy between both that you could sell. I think in a perfect world, I think TKO would like to have their WWE and UFC pay-per-view offerings under the same umbrella with the same distribution method and the same way to be able to market these shows. But the market is going to dictate where the demand is for that. If ESPN is going to pay this gigantic increase for the UFC package, and that includes pay-per-views, are you getting that much more by putting in a big bid for WWE pay-per-views on top of that? And I think Peacock is going to be very aggressive in trying to keep those WWE shows. I think Peacock is like, I don't undersell the WWE as, you know, one of the core programming pillars that Peacock has outside. Like, it's great to have the Olympics every 4 years, but for a month to month product, WWE has been very reliable for them.
Yeah. I guess if it were to happen, WrestleMania would be the easiest one to justify, right? Because that's going to have by far the most demand. I guess if I'm negotiating a deal, there's just a lot of uncertainty there in terms of if you're Comcast, you know, NBC Universal or Disney, what's the trade-off value? What's the buy demand at whatever, $60, whatever it might be for WrestleMania? How many pay-per-view buys can I sell? At this point, when the genie's been put in the bottle, to take the genie back out of the bottle, I think creates a lot of uncertainty in terms of knowing what the sales of that product would be, and knowing how to, you know, weigh that against what the product is now, which is $200 million a year, including everything, including WrestleMania and the library. I just think it's hard for the people who have to make the deal to, you know, to accurately value what that offering would be worth.
Yeah, And we're looking at AEW as sort of this last wrestling example of an audience that is spending money every month and spending $45 to $50 for a pay-per-view. That I could certainly see that model going away for AEW in this next deal, as you're just further educating your audience to just get this on a streaming app, and the company gets their guaranteed revenue fix each month, and it's less, this a la carte business that wrestling fans have been trained to accept. But we have a whole generation of fans that are coming up now with the WWE Network. We're talking a 10-year-old system and not paying for a WWE pay-per-view in the traditional sense in the past decade. I think it'd be very hard for them to go back for anything beyond a WrestleMania. And even then, you might get some friction of people that have been getting these two-night WrestleManias for their Peacock subscription package, and all of a sudden you're gonna increase the price by six times for a WrestleMania event, and maybe over two nights.
Yeah, and that's the math of the Peacock deal making sense is that the Peacock deal paid WWE well above what they were generating on their own with the WWE Network. So it wasn't just, you know, with what they say in terms of, oh, we're not a tech company, why are we doing this on our own? But it was that Peacock was willing to spend so much in the near term to get the content that they wanted to help them build their streaming service. So it's well above what the WWE Network was generating, certainly in terms of revenue, which the WWE Network itself was well above what the pay-per-view business was generating. But of course, it was with like a 45-55% split with the pay-per-view carrier. But yeah, that was another business model ago.
And the final note, I guess, of worth bringing up from Mark Shapiro was the idea of shoulder programming with Netflix, indicating a drive to survive style of program for WWE and documentaries. And Mark Shapiro, very confident Netflix is going to continue with their roasts beyond Tom Brady, who sounds like he's very regretful now of doing this roast.
Is he? Is Tom Brady sorry that he did it? It
sounds like his ex-wife was not too happy about the roast.
I saw he had to walk up to somebody and whisper something in their ear, because you can say whatever you want about him, but you better not besmirch the name of Bob Kraft. Okay, he's an NFL owner.
That's
right. In this society, NFL owners are on the top, and everybody else is down beneath them.
Yes. Yeah. Jeffrey Ross got an earful here. It's been debated if this was a bit or not. But yeah, Tom Brady, I mean, there were no holds barred on this particular roast. I mean, 3+ hour roast too. I mean, geez.
That's right. So whether it's Bob Kraft, if Shad Khan shows up on TV, that's a big deal.
Yes. Well, so look forward to more reality programming from WWE.
No mention of the Vince documentary here, correct?
It never was brought up. Last week, Netflix unveiled their lineup of sports documentaries. So, I mean, some wiggle room here if you would classify the Vince McMahon doc as sports or not, but
maybe crime.
It very well could be a true crime doc by the end of things. And no mention of this at all by Netflix last week during the whole upfront presentations in New York City. I would state that Netflix documentary seems like it is, at the very least, I mean, to have any kind of release, the story is still in motion at the moment. And you're not going to get, I mean, it creates a really difficult position for the Netflix WWE partnership, in that Netflix is obviously going to want promotion out of WWE, who I don't think want to touch this thing at the moment and promote anything regarding Vince McMahon on their programming. I would say both sides probably are realizing that the level of toxicity attached to Vince McMahon's name, probably not the greatest time to be releasing this documentary series, but they have put so much into this, like millions. I can't see it just being shelved forever. I think that at some point this thing has to see the light of day.
And this is something that's been in production, or at least announced to have been in production, well before the news and the scandal that began to come out in 2022. And at that time, WWE and Netflix were not business partners as they are today. I don't know if we should call it a journalistic piece. It's a documentary on Netflix. But it, in terms of telling a story that, you know, isn't conflicted, I mean, certainly there's a conflict now in terms of this is a huge partnership for both companies. So it casts a conflict onto how they want to tell that story. And you don't want to, if you're Netflix, you don't want to aggravate any problems with this brand that's very important to creating some live events that are going to be weekly, which is going to be a big step for your streaming service. And if you're WWE, you definitely don't want to aggravate the Vince issue, which they've gone to such pains to try to avoid.
Will the series be called Thank You, Vince, through the eyes of Stephanie McMahon, the Vince McMahon story?
I don't even know what Stephanie's true perspective is on the story. It's a story that needs to be told maybe 10 years from now, certainly.
Would Stephanie McMahon be interviewed on this documentary series?
What a mess.
It's just something else. I'm not holding my breath for the release of this documentary in the foreseeable future, but we will see. I still believe it will eventually get out. Let's move on over to Saudi Arabia, where WWE is returning this coming weekend with the King and Queen of the Ring. And just the fact that a title like that is happening in Saudi Arabia, I mean, what progress that they have made since 2018, when a video featuring several of the female performers aired in Jeddah on that Greatest Royal Rumble show, and an apology had to be issued afterward for some of these women being shown, and stated it would never happen again. I have the statement here. The General Sports Authority would like to apologize to the viewers and attendees of last night's WWE event that took place in Jeddah over the indecent scene involving women that appeared as an ad before a segment. It would like to confirm its total disapproval of this in the shadow of its commitment to eliminate anything that goes against the community's values.
Yes. Well, they've wrestled since in full body suits, so I think that was the main issue there, right?
Yes. This evolved where Renee Young was technically the first female attached to any of these Saudi Arabia shows, for she was on the broadcast calling the show in November 2018, which was the show that was under the greatest scrutiny because we're talking 1 month removed from the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And then the following year, as you can see here, Natalia and Lacey Evans having the first women's match. And since that time, we have done away with the oversized t-shirts, and they have worked their way into actual wrestling gear, although covered. And now the women's involvement on these shows is just, it's part of the shows now for all of these Saudi Arabia events. So I thought this was a good chance to kind of look at, here we are roughly around the midpoint of this 10-year deal and where the kind of public's stance is, especially within wrestling, and contrast it. Because, I mean, we just had the Tyson Fury fight this past Saturday in Saudi Arabia. It's become a beacon for big boxing fights to be taking place in. And from a fan perspective, especially like in boxing, this is being celebrated. I think there's the understanding of some of the conflict that comes with Saudi Arabia, but to a consumer, they're getting these great fights. They're getting these big events. And I would say in wrestling, it's how would you assess how the temperature has changed from, I would say, that peak stage post Jamal Khashoggi's murder in 2018, where it was a very, very dark cloud that they were performing under, and where we are today in 2024 when it comes to these shows? Because they have, to me, I feel like these have been normalized to a great degree, and you don't see any of the kind of larger issues, I think, being focused on any longer.
I heard, now we were both at WrestleMania both nights in the press box, hard to hear the crowd, but I heard, you know, people say that when they promoted this King and Queen of the Ring in Saudi Arabia, that people booed. There was that.
Yeah. And that was audible. I did watch the clip afterwards. Like, it was audible on the broadcast that you could hear those boos. And that caught me off guard. I was not expecting that reaction, because I don't sense that reaction from a lot of people for these events. And you can argue it. I think that there is a lot of somewhat, I don't want to say indifference, because I don't think that's the proper term for it. But I think for most, the Jamal Khashoggi murder was just so egregious that it was even like, you just can't overlook it. But there's the same sense with a lot of people that these events are happening. This is something that, There's not going to be any kind of sanctions against someone the level of an MBS. And I think a lot of your fans are, again, not indifferent, but it's just like a feeling of like, it's a powerless feeling that these shows, they're going to happen. And are we simply just bringing this up repeatedly without any changes? And you can look at it. We'll get into this more in the interview about changes in the country that have occurred, but also like still a lot of underlying issues within the country when it comes to just basic protest or free speech that are being policed very, very heavily.
And the product, the WWE product, is better now. A lot more people are satisfied with it and have less reason to be disenfranchised and angry with the product that WWE is serving, which certainly in the early events of this deal was highlighted in terms of how bad these shows were early on. Some of them have been better, right? So I think it behooves WWE to try to put on a great show here. And we haven't seen the usual, reprising of people from the past, not even Brock Lesnar. I know Brock Lesnar is a different story, obviously, but we're not seeing, bringing back out people like The Undertaker or Shawn Michaels and Kane to have a match here.
You've also seen Sami Zayn, who was, that absence on the early shows was very hard for people to get around. It was like just shining a light on it. But now Sami Zayn is part of these shows, and you don't have, but like that was like this kind of spotlight on other issues. Like if you were just simply a wrestling fan and watching this and not concerned about the politics, you go and watch this show and hear there's no females on this show. Sami Zayn is not on this show. And it's almost forcing you. Remember that first show where you had Mansoor and several of the other like Saudi Arabian based wrestlers, and out come the Daivaris representing Iran. And like, insanity that they booked this angle on that show. And I think that it is,
they got death threats, they said.
I am not surprised. I think it was an absolutely just like like what you are watching that first show. It was so hard for that Greatest Royal Rumble show to watch it at, just in the prism of a wrestling show, because it was so clear it was not. This had so many political overtones to it, and just selling the country, and then doing like this incredibly insensitive angle involving like real hostilities involving Iran and Saudi Arabia as an angle on the show.
Yeah. And I what makes those early shows, and we'll watch, you know, this weekend to see what happens here in terms of, are there any promotional materials, promotional videos that are seen, as there were in those early events where there was literally a Mohammed bin Salman video piece sort of promoting what a progressive leader he was. And we've seen similar things in Cardiff for the Clash of the Castle. There's some tourism promotional videos similar for Puerto Rico. And I guess that brings me to the question that people sometimes ask in terms of, I mean, especially we're going on and on earlier about site fees. And we'll talk later about what's going on in Texas. You know, why is it a big deal? Why are you complaining so much and talking so much about the Saudi Arabia deal when they're doing deals? They are doing deals with governments now. We used to say there were no deals with governments. They were just, you know, entrepreneurially booking events in cities and in other countries and basically running them on their own. This is different in that it is a direct government partnership. But now, as we're seeing, they are trying more than ever to make deals with municipalities all over the world. And how is that any different than this, when you could even say, you know, if you're doing deals with local governments in Texas, ultimately a lot of that money is coming from the state. There's probably a lot of laws and political issues that we could complain about in Texas just as well. I don't know if they're exactly equal, but just as well as you could in the case of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, this was actually brought up on our Ask Away show last week, specifically comparing Texas to Saudi Arabia. And I think it does open up that discussion point. I would state to that number one, I don't view them as like in the same like comparison level. But if we're just exploring this, regardless of what Texas is willing to pay for these shows, it's going to be a regular touring stop for WWE. But I think we also have to look at scale. And when you're seeing the Puerto Rican government, correct me if I'm wrong, $1.5 million for the SmackDown Backlash combination. So if
$300,000 for the venue, yeah. So if we could put it to the extreme, I believe WrestleMania 38 in 2022, Dallas, they got probably $9 million worth of reimbursements and a little bit of cash. So we could go $9 million for two events. So and all the WrestleMania stuff versus 50 for this.
Exactly. And I think we have to look at as well. And again, this is not to say, like when we were talking about the Oklahoma story last week, like that is an event. They are not paying AEW or WWE to come in. But as
Oklahoma
I mentioned,
Oklahoma does take a tax, though. They take a tax on the ticket sales.
They do get something out of this. But the next time AEW were to run a show there, and if the same law is in place and AEW runs that show without Nyla Rose, absolutely AEW is going to catch flack for that over the idea. And that is, again, looking at kind of a local sports commission that is government supported and a company opting to run a state or not, and how they are going to acquiesce their own values to running a state. I think that's going to be fair game. But getting back to the difference there is, if Saudi Arabia is spending $50 million for these level of shows and a WrestleMania, the rate is $9 million. Well, what is making up that difference of $41 million? What is the value Saudi Arabia sees in that gap that they are spending so much for, that this is, yes, you are bringing an event to your people. And believe me, the audience in Saudi Arabia, this is great for them to be able to get all these concerts and sports events, have a great time. But I think we also have to look at it from the side of like, what are they getting for that $50 million that is not tangible? Because this is not to scale of what these events are worth to any other country in the world outside of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I mean, in reading some of Blood and Oil, which is the book written by Bradley Hope in our preparation for our interview with him, which we're going to air in a moment, you get a picture of a country that has a new ruler, crown prince, who's the de facto leader of the country, Mohammed bin Salman. And you have a country that is, you know, in a sense, very wealthy. Certainly the royal family is extremely wealthy. They have a lot of money. I think the country has a fairly high GDP, right, per capita. But eventually, oil is going to run out. Oil is not a renewable resource. And they're trying very aggressively to use the resources that they have now and translate those into other forms of business. And part of that is spending a lot, spending as much as it takes to bring these events over and, you know, create the perception that Saudi Arabia would be a great tourist destination. Creating the sense that this is, you know, a welcoming government. This is a good place to visit. This is a normal place. And that's what they're paying for. And to get WWE to, you know, revert their schedule of, you know, running pay-per-views in the United States or Canada for the most part, but to go well out of their way to do this in the Middle East.
Yeah. And that's, something that's spoken about in the book is that from MBS's perspective was that a lot of people within Saudi Arabia, you would have all this disposable income, but they were leaving the country to enjoy these entertainment options. They would go to a Dubai, they would go overseas. And instead the idea was, how do we get people to stay and spend within the country? And tourism is a giant builder for them. Mohammed bin Salman has mentioned that Saudi Arabia in 2022, they had 40 million visitors into the country. They want that to be over 100 million by 2030. So when you see these ideas like a WrestleMania being thrown out there, like tourism is a huge factor. We don't want just our citizens spending money. We want people coming. We want people spending their money, and we want people leaving, having a tremendous time in Saudi Arabia. And this becomes a destination spot, no different than other places abroad for.
I don't know if people. We buried the lead, but part of what Mark Spiro was talking about there is renewing this deal, expanding the deal, whatever that means. Does that mean making this longer term? We're already under a deal that's not going to expire until 2028, but the speculation is that does there end up being a Royal Rumble in Saudi Arabia or even a WrestleMania there someday?
The greater Royal Rumble.
Great. Yeah, it's already the greatest. I mean, there's nothing greater than the greatest.
The last thing I want to do before we get to our interview is just air this quick clip. This was Ari Emanuel on Freakonomics Radio last year, and he was asked about this. And Ari Emanuel is an interesting figure because he had negotiated this investment from the Saudi Arabian government of $400 million through negotiating with MBS. And then after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, he turned around and returned this money. And this is Ari Emanuel kind of going through in real time, kind of working out how he has been able to justify this. Because I truly believe, and maybe I'm being a little naive, that I don't believe Ari Emanuel is simply a monetary viewpoint on this. I do think he weighs some level of ethics to these decisions. But here's Ari Emanuel.
So we negotiated, took about 9 months in the negotiation for them to invest, I think it was $400 million. And then, you know, I think a bad thing happened. But let's be very clear about something. I'm not defending what they did. You know, I've had a brother that's been in two White Houses. Every country does bad things. They just don't do it in an embassy. Right or wrong, we killed an American citizen who was a terrorist with no trial.
Emanuel is referring to the 2011 drone strike in Yemen that killed Anwar al-Awlaki, an al-Qaeda leader born in New Mexico. But what was the mechanism then? Did you literally write a check back with interest?
Well, it was a long negotiation. Yeah, we wrote a check back with interest, yeah.
Does that preclude you from doing business with him or them again?
No. But we wrote a check. Listen, I know everybody thinks things are black and white. And I have a tendency to do that too, right? And we live in this period of time where, you know, there was a period of time where it was even worse. And I struggle with this. And we do business there. I mean, people drive cars that oil. I mean, like, let's get through a bunch of stuff here. So governments do bad things. Let's just say that. and then work through all our own emotional ethics.
But why was that the case that made you write a check for $400 million?
I don't know. I just, you know, I don't really know.
So a few things there from Ari Emanuel. Again, this was from last year. And since that time, you have seen, you know, the UFC, they are about to stage their first event in Saudi Arabia coming up on June 22nd. They are now very much involved. This was also around the time they were still in the process of finalizing the TKO merger that has deep ties with the WWE Saudi Arabia relationship. But
all governments do bad things.
All governments do bad things.
What does that mean then? Like, so there are no standards. There's no line to draw in terms of what's tolerable and not.
Well, I think that this is number one. That was not his stance in 2018 when Jamal Khashoggi was murdered. And he could have very easily told himself that to state, I'm going to keep this $400 million. So you have seen his thoughts on this evolve. And I do feel that is obviously intrinsically tied to his business dealings, that this is a reality, that I am doing business with this company. And I think he is someone that I, like you have just seen, like, I don't think he has a very clear answer on this. And I think if you were to go back to 2018 and he had the ability to have the foresight, he probably is not handing back that money, believing that ultimately this is going to be something that is at least, if not rationalized, at least is just accepted as someone that is, can a government get away with the murder of a journalist? In this case, the answer kind of is yes, as you know, frightening as that might be to people to hear, that is the reality of this. Of all the people that refused to go back for Davos in the desert and they wouldn't do business with Saudi Arabia, well, most, if not all of them, have all come back to the table and were on. And to use this equivalency that all governments do bad things, yes, governments do bad things, but specific here to this one, it's one that there was a pause when it happened. And since that time, you have seen a lot of kind of a 180 in terms of the realistic, the realities of a country that is spending billions of dollars and that a lot of these people are incentivized to overlook human rights atrocities.
Yeah. And I guess the follow-up is that, well, there weren't additional high profile. And the Khashoggi murder is itself, I think, it's a story that people focused on. It's one person being killed, being lured, who is a public figure, who is a Washington Post columnist, who is a well-known figure within, you know, news coverage of the Middle East. There's plenty of other human rights abuses that you could focus on that killed more than one person. But it's just the fact that it's sort of like the saying that, you know, killing, you know, millions of people is a statistic, but, you know, killing one person is a tragedy. But it became a much bigger story. But I think it's probably just a path of least resistance in that, well, you know, do I want to, you know, just, you know, acquiesce to the pressure of having to deliver value for shareholders, or do I want to take a moral stand on this? And in the world of publicly traded companies, or even companies that are, you know, held by private equity and have those people to answer to, usually, you know, the moral consideration doesn't come first, certainly not if there aren't legal considerations to press those moral considerations to be acted on.
So that will take us into our discussion now with author Bradley Hope, who we spoke with just earlier today. He is the co-author of Blood and Oil, and here he is joining us on Pollock and Thurston. Coming up this Saturday, WWE is going to be holding its latest event in Saudi Arabia. It's part of a 10-year agreement that the company has with the Saudi Arabian government. And here to speak with us about Saudi Arabia's growing influence in sport and abroad, he is the co-author of Blood and Money, Bradley Hope, joining us now. Bradley, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate the time.
My pleasure.
Let's start off with, you know, you were based in the Middle East for a good portion of your career, and in your reporting and then the release of your book in 2020, can you just tell me a bit about, in your own eyes, the growing influence that you have seen just within Saudi Arabia just in the 4 years since your book has come out and where we are at present, where especially in sport and the perspective we're coming at it from, it just seems it is enormous in terms of the impact it's having in professional wrestling, boxing, F1, and so many other sports now.
Yeah, I think when I was living in the region back in the sort of 2008 till 2016 period, 2008 to 2013 period, Saudi Arabia was this kind of quiet place. There was not a lot going on. It was, you know, a kind of a large country with a lot of money and oil, but it just was very quiet. Even when you went there on a conference or something, it would just not be a very vibrant place. And ever since MBS rose to power with his father, that country has become, you know, globally recognized on every possible level in geopolitics, in investing. You know, they're one of the most active investors in the world. And then more recently, just exploding in the world of entertainment and sports. And it just shows that this new crown prince, who's in reality, he's like the acting king of Saudi Arabia. He is just has so much energy and so much focus on bringing the country into the sort of 21st century and changing its reputation from this sleepy conservative country that people have kind of heard of, but maybe not for good things. And that's what's driving this. You know, it's a country that's increasingly run by young people as well. So a lot of, you know, it's an absolute monarchy. So it's theoretically just one man in power. But in reality, there's still a kind of politics. He still has a mandate from the people of the country. And his mandate since day one has really been about the young population, because Saudi Arabia has had an explosion of youth over the last 50 years. It went from a pretty small place to a pretty big place. And those youth population that are so core to his mandate are part of what's driving this interest in sports. That's what the young Saudis want, and so that's what he's bringing them.
And I was wondering, Bradley, if you could tell us about the relationship between MBS and Turki Al-Sheikh, who is somebody that wrestling fans see every now and then, and MMA fans and boxing fans as well, as somebody who is – he's the chairman of the General Entertainment Authority. He's done sort of these photo ops with wrestling personalities around these WWE events. And so if you could tell us like what his story is and how he came to be the chairman and the person who's overseeing all these entertainment and sports events.
Yeah, well, he's a fascinating character. He and another guy called Prince Badr are two people that were very close to MBS before he rose to power. So they knew him when he was just a relatively unknown prince. And so they have that deep trust and relationship based on the fact that they kind of came up together. They grew up together to some extent. And so Turki had different jobs in the government. He's not a member of the royal family, unlike Prince Badr, but he had different jobs in the Ministry of Interior, which is essentially the police of Saudi Arabia. And he doesn't have really qualifications that would have suggested he would have this role, other than the fact that he had this really close relationship with MBS, part of the inner royal court, so to speak. And he has a great, he's a very entertaining guy. He's kind of the life of the party. And he's always been that way. He's kind of the person that's keeping everyone in this small, powerful entourage laughing for years. And so just naturally, as MBS took power, he was given a kind of job, and it was unclear if he was going to keep that job, but he has been quite successful at bringing big sports stars to Saudi Arabia, throwing some of Saudi Arabia's most kind of elaborate events. They have all these things called seasons. So there's Riyadh season, Jeddah season. It's like these huge activity events for the Saudi population. And he's also kind of the master of ceremonies for some of these big sporting events. And, you know, he's quite a character too. There was a video that was going around for, you know, a few years ago where he was playing FIFA, the video game, and he lost and he destroyed the screen, the TV screen. And it was just like, he just walked away, like a giant screen. He just like smashed it and left, you know? So I think he's kind of relatable in a way, to a part of the population, because he's kind of the wild character, the life of the party. And that's kind of, and I think that's what actually makes him a great relationship manager for these celebrities. They also enjoy spending time with them. And of course, the guy has an enormous amount of money to spend and entertain with and, you know, enjoy with everybody.
So, I mean, the term that is so frequently utilized, and I think people have different definitions for it, of sports washing. And I think to some people, they look at, you know, their Saudi Arabia's investment in sports and bringing a lot of these major entertainment and sports vehicles to the country with the idea that this is kind of providing a sheen for a lot of the human rights issues and other elements of the country. In 2024, is that still a very fair assessment? Have you observed advancements in Saudi Arabia under MBS's reign? Or is that sort of like what the strategy is at play here, that there are still a lot of repressive aspects of the culture, but this is also very much fulfilling a lot of your younger audience and they're getting all of these different sporting and live entertainment events that it does kind of provide for a bit of a, you know, distraction from other realities?
Yeah, I think so. I never liked the term sports washing because I know that this is such a painful term in Saudi Arabia to hear because it has nothing to do with the way that they think about it. What they're thinking about is a few different things, right? They're trying to make their own population happy, make it a place, make Saudi Arabia a place to stay, not to leave all the time. Every time you want to enjoy something, you don't want your population leaving the country to go next door to Dubai or somewhere else,
right?
Or to Europe or to America. So that's an element of it. The other element is that part of this economic transformation of Saudi Arabia, tourism actually plays an important role. So MBS genuinely wants Saudi Arabia to be a tourist destination, and that means making it entertaining. So they're building hotels, they're building event spaces. Of course, you want to have reasons to attend, you know, Formula One races and boxing matches and things like that, you know. So the country is transforming rapidly. It's so rapid that if you go visit Saudi Arabia 1 month and you come back again 6 months later, it feels different already, you know. So it's undergoing a huge transformation. Now, of course, MBS has always been very concerned with the image of Saudi Arabia as a conservative, repressive, negative place, and has been working very hard to change that. And so part of changing that is to prove it's not like what it used to be. So yeah, you can call that like a sort of a PR event to prove that Saudi Arabia is different. But in Saudi Arabia, there's nobody there being like, let's open up the cash reserves for sports washing. You know, they're thinking we love sports. Our population loves sports. Tourists love sports, you know? So I think it's a little bit unfair to say that it's really just for this purpose. And it really comes from the point of view of a kind of critical Western audience to think that that's the reason they're doing this kind of stuff. And that's just not how it works over there or anywhere, to be honest.
Yeah. So our reporting has shown, it's basically been confirmed in a number of ways by WB's reporting, that Saudi Arabia, the government, is paying about $50 million for each event. They do two of these events a year, so it's about $100 million a year. There was discussion from TKO's president, Mark Shapiro, just the other day that they're looking to expand the deal, which is currently, it's a 10-year deal that I believe would go to about 2028. But it's to put that in some perspective for the audience, $50 million is like twice as much money as any wrestling event has ever drawn on a single day in ticket sales. So it's a fee way above what's normal for a WWE event. So it's raised a criticism that it looks like they're overpaying for something, and they're doing public relations, not only helping Saudi Arabia with, you know, the Vision 2030 and moving Saudi Arabia into different forms of economics, but it's also presenting to Western viewers who are watching WWE throughout the world on Peacock in the United States, this, you know, this event where, hey, look, this is an event in Saudi Arabia and everything looks fun and entertaining and fine here, and then it looks normal. Do you feel like that's a legitimate criticism, or is that unfair?
No, I think that's the startup cost of convincing new sports, new events to come to Saudi Arabia. It's not a natural place to go. Like, no one's going to go there and do it at a discount. You know, the startup cost of really getting into this kind of thing is you have to pay more. You know, I think a good example is, you know, when Netflix in the early years, when they were doing deals with like celebrities and writers and stuff, they were paying them crazy money. They would say, we're paying a writer like $100 million or something crazy like that. And nowadays Netflix doesn't do those deals anymore. But in the beginning, they had to. They had to do big deals with high profit margins to convince people to work exclusively with them, you know? So I think Saudi Arabia, what we'll see is all of the first deals, the first years of these deals will be very hefty and very profitable. But over time, they will actually start to get more regular and more normal, you know? So I think, again, it's not like they're purposefully overpaying. This is the kind of startup cost. Like, you know, there's never been WWE in Saudi Arabia before. How do we convince them to come, you know, despite other reasons, you know, the lack of infrastructure to some extent, or even maybe some of the, you know, the critics that are out there saying, you know, so they're not going to have WWE come and do, WWE is not going to want to come and do something that is at cost. You know, they're going to want to have a margin to set up a new, essentially a franchise in this country.
In your book, you also, you know, in speaking about like the younger population, I think you cited like 60% of the population under the age of 30, at least at the time of your reporting with the book. And one thing that really comes very clear, like MBS is someone that is still under the age of 40. He has risen up in his 30s, and someone that I certainly took from reading is really understood the power of social media, and in particular Twitter, how that is very engaging for that younger population. And it seems as though MBS both understands the usefulness of something like social media, but also the other side of it is that seems very reticent to be criticized on that platform, where we have seen some of these enormous punishments up to and including death when it comes to criticism on the platform. I just want some of your thought on his kind of thinking towards social media as a tool in a lot of his kind of efforts.
Yeah, I think it goes to the heart of the way this idea exists today. It is a bit of a mirage to look at all these things happening, you know, women walking around with their heads uncovered. These are things that weren't happening before. You know, equality in the workplace, more rights to intermingle, having music playing. These are all new developments in Saudi Arabia. But at the same time, while the social side has made progress, the political side is almost gone backwards. And it comes to this core concept in Saudi Arabia, which is they are becoming more socially liberal, but they believe in retaining the absolute monarchy. And in absolute monarchy, you can't have people in the streets protesting. This is their thinking. They have to come and sort of ask the king. They have to ask the crown prince, saying, we want this new right. Will you give it to us? It's not, we have the right and you have to recognize it. It's, we want the right. Will you give it to us? You know? And so this is very alien for us as Americans to imagine a scenario like that. But that is the way that Saudi Arabia is set up. And so everyone has these tools, social media, and they can increasingly talk about things and, you know, push the boundaries. But what they can't push the boundaries on is the political side. They will, and this is kind of true across the whole Arabian Gulf, you know, with the UAE and Saudi and Qatar, is they will not accept criticism of the royal family. And they have their reasons, which is they think that if those countries were to open up to democracy, you would get the wrong kind of people in charge. You know, you'd get people that could take it on dangerous pathways. You know, like, they don't really believe in democracy for their countries. And so that's why it's kind of confusing and tricky, because it seems normal. It seems like it's increasingly westernized. But in reality, it is still an absolute monarchy, where these are not rights that are given to people. You know, you can't protest. You can't criticize the ruler. And in Saudi, the only thing you're allowed to do is criticize, like, if the water authority is failing to provide water to you, you can criticize that. But then you wouldn't say, this is the crown prince's fault. His government is doing a bad job. You would just say, the guy in charge of the water isn't doing a bad job. And so, it is tricky. And I think a lot of young Saudis have gotten themselves in trouble, especially in the early days of MBS's rise, thinking that the social liberalization also meant they could be more politically open and more politically ambitious. And they really suffered huge consequences. I think in general, this is not the kind of place where you're getting executed for Twitter activity. It's much more like There are some certain examples where people have gone to prison for longer periods of time. There's a lot of people in prison in Saudi Arabia. It's unclear what is the kind of judicial process for why they're still in prison. You know, there's a famous case of a guy who criticized the oil company having a public offering, an IPO. And that guy hasn't been heard of. You know, I'm not sure if he's out or not, but he did get in trouble for a long time, at least, maybe still in trouble, just for criticizing that. So, you know, that's kind of the situation in Saudi Arabia.
And what has made WWE and Saudi Arabia's relationship really interesting and a big story for us to cover is this is a deal that started in 2018, and they did one event in April of 2018, and then they did their second event in November of 2018, which was exactly 1 month after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, which of course was a huge international story. So I think something that people are wondering about is, you know, we hear these messages about how MBS is a progressive ruler and things are changing. How much has human rights improved, if at all, since 2018 or so?
Yeah, I think, in Saudi Arabia.
To what degree, if any, do these sports and entertainment events like WWE contribute to any change that's happening?
Yeah, I think, in Saudi Arabia, in the leadership, the high echelons of leadership, there's no discussion there of the Khashoggi killing as being an attack on journalism, right? That's how we see it in the rest of the world, because he was also a journalist, among other things, and he was writing these critical pieces. And so we made a sort of external linkage between, oh, he wrote something negative, therefore he was killed. But in Saudi Arabia, he's seen more as kind of like a traitor because he was closely working for the royal family for his whole career, not really as like a journalist in the traditional sense. And then he started doing these things that were against the royal family. And so and he was connected to other people, and, you know, they had their own imagination about why this was the case. So anyway, that's an important thing to note, because they don't see things the way that we portray them or we see them from our point of view, you know? So I think that's an important initial thought, because they don't think that they have a problem with attacking people for free speech. But on the other hand, they're very concerned about their reputation. They don't want to be seen as a country that is murderous, that doesn't believe in journalism and all these things that are internationally accepted as good things. So anything that they can do to show that this is a normal place where normal things happen is useful to them, you know? I just don't think it's the primary reason why they're doing it. And the fact that there was something that came right after the Jamal Khashoggi thing, it shows that ultimately commerce and business is less judgmental than sort of international politics. You know, I remember that there was this conference that they have every year in Saudi Arabia that ever since MBS rose to power, called the FII, the Future Investment Initiative. And everybody in the world would come for this conference. And then after Khashoggi, no one showed up for 1 year. Then the second year, they all came back, you know? Right. So business people have a short memory for this kind of thing, and they are eager for things to return to normal. And I think the other reason people are wanting things to return to normal is they realize that MBS wasn't going anywhere. There was a lot of discussion after the Khashoggi killing that maybe the royal family would remove him and somebody else would take charge. And there was this idea that his days could be numbered. He has proven that to be completely not the case. He is really completely in control of the country. Nobody else could ever take power away from him. And add to that the huge amounts of money flowing into Saudi Arabia because of the price of oil in the last 5 years. It has made him into one of the most important, if not the most important, investor in the world. Every banker, every new startup from, you know, OpenAI, you know, anybody, they will show up in Saudi Arabia looking for an investment. And because of that, the judgmental kind of quality has completely fallen away, including the U.S. government. Joe Biden, when he came into power, said he wasn't going to meet with MBS because he wasn't on the same level as him. He would only meet the king. And Joe Biden must regret that, because a few years down the line, he realized the king wasn't going to take any calls from him, and because the crown prince was in charge. And so Joe Biden had to go to Saudi Arabia, do the fist bump. Nowadays, they're desperate for Saudi Arabia to do what the U.S. asks. The position of power kind of changed. Like, they made a bad bet that they could sort of do that, you know, and it was kind of a political move, but yeah, that's how I see it.
So like for the average WWE fan who, and there are some fans like this who feel like, I don't know if I want to watch this WWE event in Saudi Arabia. I don't know if I feel right about it. Have human rights improved at all since 2018 or so?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in the sense that the last thing Saudi Arabia would ever try to have happen is a series of events like this. The cost of the Khashoggi killing is so expensive, if you think about it, of the amount of goodwill and good PR that was exterminated by that event, that they're just so incentivized to not allow that kind of reputation to persist. So I think I think freedoms in Saudi Arabia are generally increasing, but the political side is still very restricted. But, you know, as tourists, as visitors, I don't think there would be a huge problem that you might find the same exact problem in any of the countries in the Gulf. You know, if you go to Abu Dhabi and you're starting to mouth off about the guy in charge, you know, somebody might pull you aside and say, that's not appropriate here. You know, they're not going to arrest you, but you could get yourself evicted or, you know, kicked out of the country or something like that. You know, I think they wouldn't physically harass them or try to keep them there, even try to arrest them or something. But now if you're a Saudi citizen, that's where your risks are very high. You know, if you're a Saudi person and you criticize the Crown Prince, it's very different.
Khashoggi was a Saudi citizen.
Yes, exactly. And so Saudi people and Emirati people and Qatari people and Kuwaiti people, they have to be careful what they say about their rulers, because they're not protected by sort of international outrage the same way that visitors are, you know?
We'll wrap up in just a minute, Bradley. You've been very generous with your time. I was curious, just following up on your last answer, is in the lead up to the release of your book in 2020, what you expected the reaction to be within Saudi Arabia to a book like that, and was the reaction to your expectation? Like, how would like a deep look into the rise of MBS be viewed within the country from someone outside of Saudi Arabia?
I think, you know, even though we didn't hold back, we were very... We dove deep and we put everything we could into the book that we could confirm. I think in Saudi Arabia, there's some respect that we didn't do anything unfair. You know, we sought comment on every single point. We were guided by many people in Saudi Arabia. We visited Saudi Arabia for the reporting of this book, if you can believe it. We were just very honest about what we were trying to do, why we were trying to do it. And so I think as a result, there's no sense of mean-spiritedness from us in writing this book. And so it's kind of probably grudgingly accepted. You won't find the book, as far as I'm aware, sold in the Middle East anywhere. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, a lot of Saudis were buying it here in London, and they were, the booksellers told me they would leave the cover behind, but they would take the book, you know, because the cover is kind of aggressive, you know, with the red and white. So yeah, the reaction was not like scary, you know. I think there was... It was a little bit quiet on the Middle East side.
Well, we want to thank you very much. It's been out for a few years, but Brandon and I both, we would recommend Blood and Oil, that is out there right now, along with your co-author, Justin Scheck. And you can follow Bradley on X at Bradley Hope. And anything else you want to mention, Bradley, before we say goodbye that you're in the midst of working on?
Oh, no, I've since left the Wall Street Journal, and I have a company now called Project Brazen. We make a lot of podcasts, so come check it out.
Excellent stuff. Well, thank you so much, Bradley. This has been great insight on your behalf, and we appreciate you jumping on with us.
Thanks, Bradley.
Nice to meet you.
All right, that was Bradley Hope joining us, the author of Blood and Oil. Brandon and I did get a chance, both of us, to go through this, and you know, there was one particular paragraph, Brandon, that I think you might be able to relate. And this is again from Blood and Oil. Mohammed bin Salman developed a fascination with consultants when he was setting up his own companies, and one idea he loved was the creation of key performance indicators, soon to be known throughout the ministries and government-linked companies as KPIs. Mm-hmm. He goes on to state that McKinsey, who's one of his assistants here, and a whole host of other consultants were ready to accommodate whatever big requests Mohammed made for his economic transformation plan. To get his attention, they built PowerPoint presentations with slide after slide of projections, charts, and graphs, and they loaded them with numbers, statistics, and KPIs, just the way the prince liked.
Yes. So he would love WrestleNomics, in fact, I'm sure.
Maybe he's a...
I mean, he could be listening right now.
Patron.
I mean, this is the time of the year where he would be most likely to listen, most interested, perhaps.
Well, if he wants to send in a super chat, he's more than welcome to. As are you, if you would like to get in any of your questions. But yeah, just any takeaways from the interview, Brandon, and just some of his insight or any that you had with the book?
I would say he had a more moderate view than we're used to hearing about Saudi Arabia in that. It's not, you know, according to Bradley, it's not so much about, you know, glossing over and sports washing human rights abuses, but that it's like, it's an overpaying and a deep investment now so that there can be a payoff later. This is one of my takeaways from talking with him.
Yeah, I think that I think that you have to look at whether that is the prime objective versus that being one of the effects that this also does have. I mean, there is, like, just look at the amount of people now that the prism of which they are viewing this country through is through a sporting lens. Like, that is mm-hmm. how many people now are attaching the country to these world-class events. And
this is like Las Vegas. This is where there's combat sports.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also worth noting that, and this gets forgotten sometimes, is that WWE prior to 2018, they were doing some tours in Saudi Arabia over the previous years, pre-Vision 2030, but they ran there in 2014, 2015, and 2016. And those were, again, like small house show events, nothing at the scale of what we see now. But, I mean, they were certainly like dipping their toe into running in the country prior to this giant 10-year deal as well.
Yeah, it was just house shows, a few of them over the years. But yeah, these events are the first to be televised and, you know, the first to have, as far as we know, such a big price tag attached to them.
Mm-hmm. My other thought was just that Bradley brought up is almost like this. For a younger citizen in Saudi Arabia, it's almost as though this one valve has been opened when it comes to a lot of the progress within the countries, while at the same time, it's this other valve that very much remains closed. So it's like, here, we're bringing you all of these events and we'll allow you to complain, but this is how you complain. And you don't dare state anything against the crown prince or direct. And I could imagine that it's very difficult for some people to understand what are the social norms that we are embarking on, yet still maintaining to the past. And you see, you know, examples like one that I just brought up here. This was an individual who had two Twitter accounts with 2 and 8 followers, respectively. And through his tweets, retweets, and YouTube activity, was sentenced to death over this activity. And that's not an isolated incident when you see some of these harsh punishments that are handed down for Twitter activity. And again, as we mentioned in the interview, certainly MBS has a firm understanding of the power of Twitter, but the criticism is something like as like a nothing following account is could come with that kind of punishment attached to it that do not upset and show any kind of disregard towards authority within.
And there's a fascinating story in the book about this infiltration of Twitter, where they, you know, had a relationship with somebody who's a Saudi citizen who was working for Twitter, and then they got all this information, including IP addresses, so they could and they wanted to find out who these anonymous Twitter accounts were, who were, you know, posting things on Twitter. Sometimes they were actually true about, you know, sort of the gossip of the royal family, and they wanted to find out who these people were. And the royal family ended up making, you know, a connection with somebody who worked for Twitter, who was a Saudi citizen or is a Saudi citizen, and got that information. This is about 2015. This happened. So, and it's clear that there's a different relationship, a different treatment for people who are Saudi citizens, like Jamal Khashoggi was. I don't know if it was a loyalty thing, but that, you know, there would be, if there was a WrestleMania in in Riyadh someday, that there's probably more that people visiting could get away with versus people who are their citizens.
All right, we have gone late, but we do have a few other stories to get to and an update from last week. Brandon, did the man hear our request for a response? Your pal and mine, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, did he finally respond over the past week? Did he make it in at the count of nine?
Well, he didn't respond himself, but one of his assistant attorneys, Dennis M. McKinney, has responded. And with a two-page response here, I think we can read the whole thing.
Two pages, of which one is contact information.
Yes. Redacted for all you maniacs out there. The defendant Ken Paxton, Attorney General for the state of Texas, files this original answer and general denial in response to plaintiffs, that's WB's, original petition for declaratory judgment filed herein. Here's a general denial. Pursuant to Rule 92 of the Texas Rules and Civil Procedure, defendant enters a general denial to all allegations in plaintiff's petition. Defendant Attorney General of Texas respectfully asks the court upon final hearing of this lawsuit to enter a final judgment that declares the information at issue to be subject to disclosure and orders plaintiff, that's WB, to take nothing by reason of its suit and that all costs of litigation, including court costs, should be adjudged against the plaintiff. Defendant further prays for such other and further relief, both general and special at law and inequity, to which he may be justly entitled. So they're just basically put a general answer out there saying, you know, this will perhaps prevent this case from being given a default judgment. I think I did have a little bit of interaction. This was filed by an assistant attorney general, which is what you would expect. There's many assistant attorney generals. This was filed by an assistant attorney general, Dennis McKinney, who told me that he imagines that, you know, that the attorney general's office will continue to defend this case. Cause I asked him, you know, first of all, why did this take so long to get an answer? And is this something that the attorney general's office is going to continue to defend? And he says he imagines so. And he thinks it's just one of those things that fell through the cracks and not sure why it took so long to get attention.
Well, these things fall through the cracks. And thankfully, they located the crumbs with 7 days to go before this hearing. But that is set to go, as unless there is some kind of delay, the hearing is next Wednesday in Texas. And we will see if there is any progress on this case. But I mean, encouraging at least the fact that they could have just not responded and the default judgment would have been made and it would have been just a quiet win. But it looks like
the judge could have still it would have still been up to the judge to allow a default judgment, that there is actually, you know, a lawyer on the other side now, though, is helpful in theory.
There was a story today by Sports Business Journal, and while nothing finalized for these NBA agreements, they are stating that the NBA is formalizing written contracts with Disney, NBC, and Amazon this week when it comes to the media rights negotiations, with their sources believing ESPN is ultimately going to pay $2.8 billion, while some other industry sources tabbing it at $2.6 billion, while it looks as though Comcast, NBC will be back in the NBA business for a cool $2.5, $2.6 billion, Amazon in between $1.8 and $2 billion. But the real question is Warner Brothers Discovery. How are they going to respond to this? And are we going to get a legal showdown about what a match really means? Because Warner Brothers Discovery, if you're looking at just apples to apples, cannot match the broadcast window that NBC can provide because WBD does not have a broadcast network. And at least WBD, they have indicated the idea that they may have an ability to match through unconventional means. But I don't know too many people that are backing that assertion. But that means lawyers are just, oh, let's debate what a match is.
Yeah, I wonder if whatever rights that Amazon might be getting here, if WBD will be arguing that they have a right to match any of that. I don't know. I know there was some chatter about whether or not WBD actually does have a right to match that offer. But maybe there'll be some settlement and WBD will get a piece of the NBA rights or something like that. But I think the likeliest outcome at this point, I think, is that there's going to be no NBA on TNT after the next season. We'll have one more season of this. and even inside the NBA could go away here.
So yes, a lot of
what does this have to do with wrestling?
Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, TNT is not going away, and they're going to have a lot of programming to fill. And if they don't have to be spending billions per year on the NBA, that in theory leaves them with a lot of a programming budget. Now,
give all that to AEW. Yeah,
they could. They could also pay down some of their, I believe, $40 billion in debt. That could also be some allocation of funds. But you would think that unless TNT is just completely giving up as a cable network and thinking that, man, we're going to get destroyed with our carriage fee drop. They need programming, and they still have high level sports programming, and AEW is coming due. And again, it's a total crapshoot what these AEW negotiations are going to end with. With who? We're still in a negotiating window and into the summer, according to Fightful. So it's not as though AEW is even on the open market.
Yeah, I think those are the two issues that we're waiting for, is the resolution of NBA rights, and then some of AEW's got to go to the open market, I think, to at least explore what the deal might be. Or maybe WBD just wants to make them a great offer right before the window opens. I think on balance, this is, if there's no NBA on WBD, on balance, it's a good thing for AEW. Obviously there are some negative factors, including you want to have a strong network that has something like the NBA on it. But if there's no NBA on Turner Networks, then they're going to be really eager to hold on to what they have, which includes, AEW, unless there's some huge strategic shift in terms of what these networks are going to be, and they want to, you know, or if they just want to go all out on UFC rights or something like that.
On Saturday night, AEW's 3-hour block, they had Collision followed by Rampage, with Collision doing 523,000 viewers and a 0.15, and then the Rampage that followed 391,000 viewers, a 0.13 in the demo. In particular, Collision, I mean, doing great by their standards. And this week, it will probably not be a wonderful picture for Rampage, because it is going to be moved to Friday at 6:30 Eastern time to accommodate the NBA on TNT. So Rampage not getting the benefit of the Collision lead-in this coming weekend. So that was overall, though, for a taped show that did not have, I would say, too much buzz attached to it, these numbers were very strong for AEW on Saturday.
And this was this a Canucks Oilers game on late? I think it might have been. Was that a 9 o'clock start? Because we're over on the west side of the continent there, right?
Yes, I think it was around that. That was the start time on Monday, so I assume it was the start time as well on.
So maybe not tremendous competition here, but yeah, if this was their best total viewership for Collision since September, best demo only since February, but that's still like 3 months. I don't know, just competition out of the way, I guess. I don't look at this as something that was like, hey, you can point to it, the content. That's what everybody wants to do. You have to attribute it to the content, but I don't know if this is so attributable to the content. Although apparently Tony Khan was thrilled.
Monday Night Raw this past week, 1,733,000 viewers and a 0.56, up 9% in viewership, up 6% in the demo. They got a reprieve from the NBA that had no games on Monday night, but they did go against Game 7 of the Canucks and Edmonton Oilers, which did edge them out in the 18 to 49 demographic. So NHL was first, Raw was second, and the Oilers-Canucks game, folks, I'm going to have some breaking news here for you. They did 1,656,000 viewers in the U.S. In Canada, 3,249,600 viewers for this Canucks-Oilers game. It did a phenomenal. This did like double the U.S. number. This was,
and you have what, like a tenth of the population is of the U.S. or something like that, right?
It's about a ninth, yeah.
Yeah, wow. And that, and like three times, something close to three times the viewership. I think hockey's big business in Canada. I think that might be a thing that should be invested in. Yes. Raw beating the Oilers-Canucks game in total viewership, as many people have realized, but not in the coveted P1849 demo.
Yes, which is how things are ranked with the with that 18 to 49 demographic. So Raw, yeah, they will be back with NBA competition coming up this Monday. But overall, it was a good number for Raw, and a night where they did have significantly less competition. Although there was a WNBA game that did 1,556,000 viewers. And that is the WNBA is on fire at the moment.
So this wasn't just any WNBA game. This was a Sun versus Fever game. The Indiana Fever, of course, they have Caitlin Clark. And I, you know, these WNBA games, I think Sports Media Watch has a chart. The most watched WNBA games have all happened in the recent past here with, you know, the explosion of women's basketball.
And the final note, AEW is back this weekend, back-to-back nights at the MGM Grand Garden Arena. WrestleTix, as of several days ago, had ticket figures, Double or Nothing at just over 6,400 tickets out, and Collision, again, this is several days ago, was just under 2,200. So that Collision not moving well, and no longer the automatic sellout that past Double or Nothings in Vegas were. Tony Khan is going to be holding a media call on Thursday. These press events, always very quiet, very little that ever comes out of these, and days of discussion, very, very few and far between when it comes to media calls involving WWE or AEW. I'm sure that will be the case on Thursday.
Yeah. Are you going to be online?
I am going to be on the call, yes.
Okay. All right. We won't show our hand then and discuss our questions now. Then we'll keep them guessing.
We'll ask, I don't know. We'll talk about, will security footage be brought up? Will we be talking about, it was one of my questions. Is Tony Khan going to sell this, this injury and not do the media call? Would he have put in a stand in for this particular,
are you still wearing the neck brace right now? And don't you think that the neck brace should be worn? Maybe you want to do a Bob Orton style, long-term neck brace angle, if only for the sake of the fact that, hey, you got this extra space here and everybody's looking at you when you got the neck brace on. Couldn't you put some advertising and sponsorship on that neck brace? Think of the medical device sponsorship opportunities there.
The Woo Energy neck brace. I mean, we will see. I assume he'll have the neck brace on at the press conference on Sunday.
He better.
He has to. All right. Well, that brings an end to the show. Again, a thank you to Bradley Hope for joining us. His book again, Blood and Oil. I think I called it Blood and Money about 500 times during the interview, but I meant blood
and guts.
Oil. Yeah. I found this at my local library of all places too. Found the hard copy. Brandon, much more efficient with the book, with the audiobook.
I also got the audiobook from the library.
Okay. Well, very, very nice. Is it a random voice that is?
It was not Bradley reading it to me. It was probably a voice actor. I don't know.
Okay. Well, that is it. Coming up tonight, Wei and I will be live at 10:05 PM Eastern time, unless there is a significant overrun per AEW, which we learned last week is about 12 minutes. And we will be chatting about the final Dynamite before Double or Nothing, all the latest news. And then coming up on this weekend, we'll have a show right after King and Queen of the Ring and after Double or Nothing. And Brandon, for you, when are you planning to do your show? Are you going to be doing a Sunday morning show, or are you delaying till Monday?
When is Double or Nothing? It's on Sunday night?
Sunday right? night. Yes.
Oh God. This is breaking news to me.
Multiple PLEs, pay-per-views this weekend.
Yes. Maybe I'll do it on Monday then. I'll have to consider that. So probably for subscribers, you can listen to WrestleNomics Radio on Monday, because we'll want to address anything that comes up in the press conference after the event.
Do you remember this was the weekend we were going to have these two pay-per-views, plus there was going to be the NXT show on Sunday night in Savannah, Georgia, before they moved it to the Apex. We were going to have NXT and AEW running head-to-head.
Right. Well, luckily that's being run much, much more efficiently, maybe, at the UFC Apex next week.
Yes. With tickets going on sale next week, they have announced.
They're waiting that long to put them on sale, huh? Wow.
Well, I think there's like 20 tickets to sell. So I think they're okay.
Like 250 on location experiences.
Experiences. Well, if anyone goes, I would love to hear a report from someone that goes to this Apex event of what the experience is like.
Yeah. We should send John Cena or something.
We'll send him on his trip to Vegas,
or maybe Brayden and Davey. They go everywhere, right?
They'll drive. Sure, yeah. We'll send them. All right, that's it for us, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. We do have super chats.
Yes, we do. Yes, we had at least one.
We're on top of this. Okay, Jumanji Hunter, if that's his legal name, sends in a super chat. Based on its growing demo and placement, do you view NXT as undervalued despite their new raise not even kicking in yet? Now, Brandon, what have you ascertained is the raise that NXT is expected to get on CW from? I mean, NXT, they are very coy about the value of their rights deals, whether it be USA or this move to CW.
So I've been told that it was $15 million every year that they were on the USA Network. And they've disclosed themselves that it's a 0.17 increase, which comes out to like 26 something. So I'm just rounding it to 25 in this chart here. So it's $25 million a year for NXT doing as well as it's doing. I think part of the issue here is that NXT is doing a lot better in recent times versus times before that, right? It doesn't have a sustained track record, though, of doing as well as it's doing now. If it continues to do as well as it's doing now, certainly there's an argument that it's worth more than $25 million AAV. But it needs to do that first, I would say. But I think 25 million is probably about right, right? Like in doing the math recently, I felt like it would be reasonable to maybe sell Collision and Rampage, which I would say in terms of value and what they're delivering in terms of the rank and so forth is roughly equal to what NXT is delivering. So I think it would make it makes sense for Collision and Rampage maybe to be sold for about $25 million. So I think the deal they have now, I mean, they shopped it around, I'm sure. They explored it, and this is what they got for it. But if they continue to do as well as they're doing now for a long time, for another 5 years or whatever it might be, then sure, I could see it going for more than $25 million.
Yeah, I mean, the math is incredible when you figure that NXT, at their new increase, is going to be getting for the entire year half of what WWE will make in one day on Saturday.
Yes. That's right. That's true.
Those are the economics. That's what we're talking about here. One other one here, not a question. Justin Robbins, just joining the feed, starting from the top. Don't know what you've said yet. I'm sure it's great. Well, thank you, yes. Justin. We appreciate it. We hope we sound great. We get a wide variety of feedback from people. Some yes. that think I'm
I think we set great. A new record here for duration.
Yes. Yeah. Number of minutes consumed on this show, maybe through the roof, but that is it for us. So again, I'm back tonight, 10:05 Eastern here on the Post YouTube channel. Brandon, check in Monday, follow him along, yes. patreon.com/WrestleNomics, because we got NXT numbers dropping. Dynamite, which it's the whole wrestling world stands still on Thursdays around 4 when the number comes down. And thus we know if AEW is living or dying every single Thursday. So
yes,
look forward to that. And thank you for tuning in.